president of Star King School for the Ministry, which is one of our two Unitarian Universalist seminaries. And she's quite a historian, and she did tons and tons of research on our ancestors. And this reading is something that she wrote in a poetic fashion. It's called What They Dreamed. What our ancestors dreamed, be ours to do. Let us covenant with one another to keep faith with the source of life, knowing that we are not our own. The earth made us. Let us covenant with one another to keep faith with the community of resistance and never forget that life can be saved from that which threatens it by even small bands of people, choosing to put into practice an alternative way of life. And let us covenant with one another to seek for an ever deeper awareness of that which springs up from us. Because even when our hearts are broken by our own failure or the failure of others cutting into our lives, even when we've done all we can and life is still broken, there is a universal love that has never broken faith with us and never will. And this is the ground of our hope and the reason that we can be bold in seeking to fulfill the promise. An email arrives one afternoon from the folks at American Friends Service Committee, who are community partners with Unitarian Universalists in Colorado working on immigration reform. It asks if I could meet the next morning at Senator Bennett's office for an impromptu demonstration. About 40 undocumented immigrants want to show Bennett that they really appreciate the Gang of Eight and all that he's doing at a national level for immigration reform, but until that legislation gets passed, families are being torn apart over deportation, including their families. They want to conduct a demonstration and would like a few ministers there to accompany them. Now, over the previous 4 weeks, I've been at Bennett's office twice with smaller groups of folks advocating for one immigrant in particular who was facing immediate deportation. And those meetings resulted in Bennett actually signing a letter of support for my immigrant friend, which was instrumental in getting her a delay in her deportation. Now, Bennett's chief of staff is Sarah Hughes, and she and I have become, at this point, on a first-name basis. So I respond to the email, say, yep, I'll be there. So next morning, I arrive at Bennett's office, park my car, and notice there is no one on the sidewalk. Think, maybe I got the wrong day. We typically start when a demonstration takes place on the sidewalk with a time of prayer and centering, and then we get out our signs and hoot and holler and chant and rah-rah. And the last time that we had done that, folks from the office had come out and met with us on the sidewalk. So confused, I approach the front doors of the building, and I see that what was planned as a demonstration has moved inside the building. 40 people are crammed into this entryway into the office, and I'm told in Spanish that we're trying to meet with the chief of staff, Sarah, to ask her to sign letters of support for all the immigrants present. Now, I'm honestly surprised we've even gotten in the doors. But sure enough, we're invited to come into their conference room. We wait for about 15 minutes, and then Sarah comes in. One immigrant begins to tell her story. It's translated for all of us who don't speak Spanish at all. A man tells his story, and his three children sit quietly, with big eyes, just staring around the room. The third person starts to tell her story about how she's come here and has found work and gives back to society, and her kids are in the school system, and Sarah interrupts her and says, look, I understand all of your plights, and the senator is working very hard at the national level. And then she looks straight at me, and says, Kelly, I thought I was clear the last two times you were here, that these letters are not going to become a precedent. I'm confused about why you're here again, and especially without an appointment. Well, I take the chance to engage her. I said, well, Sarah, you said that you would determine a process for how you would determine who got letters. So where are you in that process? She responds, they're working on it. Says it's very complicated. She returns to describing everything that the senator's doing on a national level, that there are concerns with writing letters. I say, well, Representative Kaufman has been signing letters these last few weeks. Doesn't Bennett want to be as supportive as Kaufman? I ask her some more questions. She answers. She and I are carrying on as if no one else is in the room. And finally, the minister sitting next to me gives me the elbow. You know the elbow? Yeah, my mom used to give me the elbow when I whispered in church during the sermons. Is anyone getting the elbow right now is what I want to know. That day, I got the elbow. And in that moment, I realize that I am dominating the conversation. I try as best I can, fumbling for the words to direct the attention back to the immigrants. What's important now, Sarah, is for these beautiful people to tell their stories. And she nods and returns her focus to those in the room. Now, you may think, Kelly, that's no big deal. I mean, really, you were there that morning. You were advocating for immigrant rights. You were getting to the core of the issue. You were speaking truth to power. You were addressing systems of oppression. But see, I wasn't there or invited to be there to do the talking. I was invited to accompany the immigrants who typically don't get to do the talking. We were, the clergy, were invited to be companions, not spokespeople. Now, you may say, Kelly, don't be so hard on yourself. You know, don't worry about it. We all do that now and again. And we do that now and again. But see, I have spent years studying this topic of companioning. I interviewed social change agents like John Fife, who started the Sanctuary Movement, and Vincent Harding, who wrote speeches for Martin Luther King Jr. I wrote papers and I developed trainings. I came here last June and taught all you all how to be companions for social change, how to contemplate the gifts we'll receive instead of how we're going to fix, help, teach, and tell. I do training about how to unlearn our patterns of dominance, like taking charge and leading and making decisions on behalf of those who are oppressed. So there, that day in Senator Bennett's office, I do all those things. I tell, I fix, I help, I take charge, and I perpetuate my pattern of privilege. So needless to say, in that moment, I feel pretty crappy. I beat myself up and analyze what's happened and just lose track of anybody else's story. I feel worn out by my big mouth. And the sadness of the whole immigration thing. All those families sitting in that room. And really, Senator Bennett and Sarah Hughes, who are working so hard, they really are, to fix the system, but they're just not getting very far. So we finish the meeting, and I go home. I sit down on the couch with a cup of coffee, and I pull out my journal. Now, journaling is the spiritual practice I use when I'm down in the dumps. When I'm happy and things are going well, meditation works just fine. But when I'm feeling awful, the journal comes out. And as a result, my journal is quite messy, and I've told everyone I know when I die, they need to get burned. The journals get burned. So now you all know that. If I die, you need to just make sure Pete, my husband, burns the journals. So sitting there with my journal, I remember the words from our reading this morning. Even when our hearts are broken by our own failure or the failure of others cutting into our lives, even when we've done all we can and life is still broken, There is a universal love that has never broken faith with us and never will. Kelly, even when your heart is broken by your own failure, there is a universal love that has never broken faith with you and never will. That is what our Unitarian Universalist ancestors ask us to remember and to depend on, especially times when we feel alone, tired, or stupid. It's what our faith offers us, one of the many things that our faith offers us, that the promise that we're loved, that we are inherently worthy by a big, we are loved by a big universal love. And we can enter into that love and feel held by it. Now, you may feel that love in various ways. Some of you may feel that it's God, or your version of Spirit of Life, or the universe. Some of you may feel that big, big love when you're in creation, grounded to Mother Earth. You may feel it during worship right here. You may feel it from each other. But when do you feel it? And in what form does it come to you? How do you feel that big love? Way back in the 1600s, our Unitarian ancestors wrote that they felt a divine spirit of love who never left and who embraced even the violators of covenant with a fire of redeeming love. Now, I am not so sure I would have felt that redeeming love if I had just whipped on to my next appointment that day. The journaling and the quieting helped me. And honestly, I wish that there had been a time of prayer and centering before the meeting at Bennett's office, because our work for social change is enhanced by spiritual practice. It helps us remember to connect with something bigger than ourselves. Andrew Harvey, who's not a Unitarian Universalist, wrote a book called The Hope. It's a guide to sacred activism. And he says that mystics have gotten addicted to being, and activists have gotten addicted to doing. But when the fire of the mystic's passion for contemplation is married to the activist's passion for change, a new kind of human being is born. Now, Reverend Kathleen McTeague is the director of the Unitarian Universalist College of Social Justice. And if any of you are on Facebook, you saw that Reverend Gretchen posted a link from Standing on the Side of Love campaign this week, where a bunch of folks were in D.C., bunch of UUs in D.C. advocating for immigration reform, and Kathleen McTeague spoke. And she has a beautiful piece on Facebook and Standing on the Side of Love site. But I actually got aware of her about 2 years ago when I read in the UU World magazine an article where she was quoted. She was talking about her new job as this director of social justice, and she said she wanted to enact her twin passions, commitment to effective social change and the work of spiritual maturity. She was quoted as saying, "Faith-based justice work is the way we take seriously the idea that we, all of us, are grounded in something larger than our political commitments." So a couple months later, I decided to call her because I wanted to know more about what she was talking about. And I was doing all this other work on companioning, researching it and investigating it. And during our phone conversation, she said this. She said, if we do social justice work in secular ways, we tend to stay in our heads, and we allow ourselves to be fooled. We need to take ourselves deeper than intellectual analysis. When we quiet our minds using spiritual practices, new insights rise up. When we get quiet together, it becomes an antidote to hubris. We tap into the cloud of witness, into our ancestors who fought for Native American rights, emancipation, suffrage, and more, and honestly didn't often get results in their lifetime. Holding onto their great witness, though, helps us stay humble and encouraged. Getting quiet links us to our tradition and gives us sustenance. So, do you have a spiritual practice? How do you quiet your mind and connect to something larger than yourself? You may notice on the cover of your order of service, you can look. You can take your eyes off me. It's just fine. On the cover, you'll see a tree of contemplative practices, which gives you ideas for practices you may try or some you may do already. And you'll notice, actually, that activism is a spiritual practice. But I like to say it's at the top of the tree. And if we only do that, if we only do activism without doing some of the other stuff, that tree might topple over. It gets a little top-heavy. We need to build our roots, our trunk, our branches. You can go to that website and find the tree. It'll be right there. And click on any of those spiritual practices, and it gives you a description of how to do it. And you can even print a blank one. They've got a blank tree there that you can print and start filling in your own practices that you like. It may be running. Someone asked me once, is running a good spiritual practice for me? And I said, well, do you run to get centered, grounded, connected to something larger than yourself and to increase your compassion? And he said, everything but that last one. And I said, well, can you work on that a little? And he said, well, sure. And I said, well, then running is a spiritual practice for you. If you run just to get your heart rate up and lose some weight, then it's not. It might be drumming for you, kayaking, singing, journaling, walking a labyrinth, praying, using beads. There's a variety of practices, and each of us have our own, and I have multiple, because like I say, you know, during the hard days, the beads and the quiet breathing doesn't work. But I have learned that over time. Kathleen McTeague says it's critical. We got to be developing individual spiritual practices, and as Unitarian Universalists, that hasn't been a big emphasis for us, really. And we don't have to tell you which one to choose. We don't have to do the same one over and over again all together, but I hope, and my invitation to you is that you'll consider it. And then she says, especially powerful to do it in small groups. Maybe take turns sharing each other's practice with each other. Now, you here at Foothills gather in small groups. You have one of the most robust small group ministries I have ever seen. You're meeting on all kinds of topics, and in particular, for social justice. The Faith Family Hospitality Homeless Ministry meets, the Immigration and Tutoring Group meets, Environmental Justice, Peace in Middle East, all those groups meeting to reflect, recharge, and renew. All those groups meeting to focus your spirit on spiritual and social transformation, both. Not just tasks, campaigns, and the roller coaster of political wins and losses. All those groups are meeting to take time to reflect on how we're connected to something larger than ourselves and how that helps us maintain compassion. It helps transform us. As people of faith, we hold brokenness collectively and communally. We hold it theologically in covenant with one another. In congregations, and with the circle of community that binds us by circumstance and choice. That's your centering thought on the order of service. See, we can depend on each other. We can lean on each other in many ways, and especially to sustain our work for justice. After my journaling and my big spiritual experience on the couch that day, I called a friend who's done immigration work with me for years. I needed to lean on her. I describe my morning to her, and she doesn't try to fix me or make me feel better. She just listens and says, uh-huh, oh. Not the judgmental, oh. But just the oh. And then I got to the part about experiencing the fire of redeeming love. And she says, well, there you have it. You can depend on that, can't you? I invite you to interdependence. Depend on universal love, however you experience it. Think about it. Go home this week and think about how you experience universal love. Depend on your own spiritual practices. What are they? And depend on each other in the circle of community. You do all these things and you will marry being and doing. And even when you feel stupid or worn out or frustrated, you do these things and you will tap into the cloud of witness of our ancestors who fought and often didn't get results. You enter dependence and you will be linked to our tradition, which will give you sustenance and encouragement. May it be so for each and all of you. Amen.